This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 157, Babylon Drift. Last time, Antiochus II died, Laodike and her brothers proclaimed Seleucus II the rightful king, and Berenike Syra declared her infant Antiochus the same. A war of subterfuge and preparation launched immediately, with King Ptolemy III tacitly occupying Seleucus Pyria until his sister was assassinated by Laodike's agents in Antioch. At that point, the Ptolemaic army swept across the Seleucus in northern Syria and into Mesopotamia, successfully assaulting at least as far as the palace citadel inside of Babylon, and probably seizing the city. So began the Third Syrian War. However, this is still a pretty substantial rewrite of how historians once interpreted Ptolemy III's claims in the last 200 years. It makes Ptolemy's later propaganda claims a lot more justifiable, if still exaggerated. At one of the Ptolemaic outposts near the Red Sea in modern Eritrea, he erected an inscription commemorating these successes in the east. That inscription is now lost, but it was copied down and recorded in the 6th century AD by a Christian monk traveling through the region. This is the version that has long made historians think Ptolemy's claims were fantastical and exaggerated. Because the Ptolemies claimed this: "But having become master of all the country this side of the Euphrates and of Cilicia, and Pamphylia, and Ionia, and the Hellespont, and Thrace, and of all the military forces in these countries, and of Indian elephants, and having made the local dynasts in these regions his vassals, he crossed the Euphrates, and having brought it under him, Mesopotamia, and Babylonia, and Susiana, and Persis, and Media, and all the rest as far as Bactria." A similar inscription, written like the Rosetta Stone in traditional hieroglyphics, Egyptian Demotic, and Greek, was also erected in Panopolis, modern Achmin. Although the Greek inscription was far longer and more detailed in its description of Ptolemy's religious accomplishments. In that decree, Ptolemy did not claim the whole bulk of the upper satrapies, but he did claim to go beyond Babylon. Though how far actually varies between the three separate scripts on the monument. In the Greek and Demotic versions, aka the two that would be most likely legible to anybody reading the inscription, Ptolemy adds Persis and Susiana to his list. But in hieroglyphics, the list stops at Susiana and does not include Persia. Interestingly, the hieroglyphics are also the only one of the three to use wording that directly implies that the army went to all of the places listed. The so-called Alexandria Decree is primarily a description of how Ptolemy ordered his forces to gather up any Egyptian artifacts they found in the former territory of the Achaemenid Empire and return them home. Several later sources attributed all of these reclaimed treasures to the malice of old Cambyses. But given the sheer number of conflicts between the Achaemenids and Egypt, we can safely assume that plenty of Persian kings had stolen Egyptian works over the centuries. Either way, this inscription says that treasures that had once been taken to Persia were returned, but only directly suggests that troops might have traveled to Susiana. The recaptured treasure was donated to various Egyptian temples, or potentially returned, which then earned Ptolemy his epithet Euergetes, the benefactor. It seems entirely plausible that the upper satrapies may have just sent Xanthippus their Egyptian relics to ward off further attacks. But given the situation at the end of the Ptolemy III Chronicle, it also seems entirely plausible that Babylon would have fallen, which would have left Seleucia on the Tigris as the only meaningful roadblock between Xanthippus and Elam, aka Susiana. Even then, the chronicle can be read as the Seleucid governor of Babylonia pulling his troops out of nearby Seleucia to defend the stronger fortress. If Babylon fell, which again seems likely, but still uncertain, it seems possible that Ptolemaic forces could actually have crossed the Zagros, even if only as a token embassy to the local satraps. None of that is settled by any stretch of the imagination, but it certainly speaks to the scale of Ptolemaic success at this time. Ptolemy Euergetes would not be the only pharaoh to ever claim that he brought back all of the treasure stolen by the Persians. And I'm sure it wasn't really all of it, but I'm willing to grant him some benefit of the doubt on this one for a pretty simple reason. That claim is everywhere in his inscriptions and later sources describing his reign. Of course, we know that an abundance of repetition is not proof of an event, but in Euergetes' case, there is another point in his favor. It's quite literally the explanation attributed to the title Euergetes in the first place. Of course, he probably also honored Egyptian temples with plenty of foreign treasure as well, but especially if his troops plundered Babylon and Sippar, I'm sure there was lots of Achaemenid-era Egyptian loot to go around. Or, potentially, Achaemenid-era Egyptian-made loot that was reinterpreted as stolen artifacts. Notably, Ptolemy I and Alexander the Great both claimed to return ancient lost Egyptian works back to their homeland from looted Persian treasuries. That framing device also played into a new propaganda angle that Ptolemy Euergetes pushed quite heavily, and one that would be adopted by his successors in their own conflicts with the Seleucids. They framed the Seleucid dynasty as the new Persian Empire, rather than a truly Macedonian or Greek heritage. By taking objects that the Persians had stolen from the Seleucids, emphasizing where rather than who held the treasure at the time, and listing off all of the relevant provinces like an old Achaemenid inscription, Ptolemy repeatedly reinforced the comparison between Seleucid and Achaemenid in many of his own monuments. This was a ploy that played well with both of his primary audiences. The propaganda campaign proved so successful that many sources describing subsequent generations of Seleucids cast them in this light by default, often even describing them as coming from Media, just as classical Greek writers described the Achaemenids. Not just in the Egyptian perspective, but in Roman and Macedonian descriptions of the Seleucids as well. On one hand, you had the Greek and Macedonian aristocracy and military class, who would have viewed this through the lens of many Greco-Persian conflicts we have discussed. Likewise, the native Egyptian populace would view it through the lens of the many, many rebellions their ancestors had fought against Persia. The Seleucids were the same as the Achaemenids, and the Achaemenids were their ancestral enemies, regardless of which side of Ptolemaic culture you found yourself on. So, if Ptolemy had all but conquered Mesopotamia and northern Syria, how do we keep going with a Seleucid Empire after this? The answer, bizarrely, lies in volcanic activity on the other side of the world. If you look at a timeline of major volcanic events worldwide, and a timeline of low water levels in the Nile River, they line up, with the Nile's lowest levels often a few years behind the volcanic eruptions. Between 247 and 244 BCE, there were four major volcanic events. Two in Japan, one in Mexico, and the last on the island of Martinique. These eruptions released massive amounts of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, ultimately disrupting wind patterns over the Indian Ocean, which in turn prevented the annual monsoon from raining down on Ethiopia. These Ethiopian monsoons feed the Nile River at its source in Lake Victoria, and the cascading effect of the mostly annual influx of water was that the Nile would flood every year, nourishing the surrounding soil and giving rise to Egypt's powerful agricultural system. So when that didn't happen, there was a famine. Famines are already expensive on their own, requiring food imports, but where exactly was Ptolemy going to import food from to begin with? Seleucus and Laodike controlled Anatolia and southern Thrace, and by extension, the Hellespont. So the Black Sea trade would be cut off. Mesopotamia had just been ransacked, and Egypt's primary western trade partner, Carthage, was in the middle of an increasingly desperate naval war with the Roman Republic. Next best western option was Sicily, which is where that war took place. On top of that, war is also expensive and required increasing taxes at home, and Ptolemy had just launched an expansive war and occupation of hostile territory. The people of northern Syria and Mesopotamia did not want a Ptolemaic military occupation, which then required stronger and more expensive garrisons to maintain. It was a perfect storm. Thebes and other parts of Egypt went into revolt, both threatening the military security of Ptolemy's home front and cutting off a huge swath of the tax base funding these occupations. And this was all before Ptolemy even needed to fight his opponent in the field. Seleucus had attempted to marshal a fleet and sail south from Anatolia, but that fleet was wrecked in a storm. This became a small mercy to Ptolemy, but still a sign that the young Seleucid king was coming to strike back. So instead of fighting Seleucus or trying to hold all of this together as an expanding empire, Ptolemy's troops ransacked northern Syria, carrying off everything of value that wasn't nailed down, to include elephants and ships of war, before returning to Egypt. He left a turncoat Seleucid noble named Antiochus to command the occupied Cilician cities, and placed Xanthippus in charge of Mesopotamia and northern Syria. But with all of the wealth removed, this was not really supposed to be a permanent occupation. These governors and their troops were just there to stir up trouble and force Seleucus to expend his resources retaking territory instead of launching a revenge campaign against Phoenicia. It's highly likely that some of Ptolemy's plunder included both food and cash that could be used to import more food and ease the tensions that brought him home. But even though we don't hear any more about this revolt, it must have taken a lot of Egyptian time and resources, because Ptolemy did not return to advance in Syria again. That said, Seleucus did not make an immediate attempt to retake his capital. By the end of 245 BCE, Antioch was firmly in Ptolemaic hands, and taking extra time to recapture it did not make a big difference. The city had fallen without a fight, so all of its defenses were undamaged, and Antioch was already a capital city on a disputed border. The Ptolemaic occupiers didn't have the resources to make it meaningly more fortified than it already was, which hardly mattered because it was just about as fortified as possible. Seleucus probably did not worry about them stockpiling food and supplies for a siege either. Not only would Antioch already have been stocked for a Ptolemaic siege by the Seleucids ahead of time, we can probably assume that any excess resources from the occupied territory got funneled back to Egypt to help with famine relief. After a storm disrupted Seleucus's first attempt to retake Syria, he would also have to rebuild his navy if he wanted to take Seleucia Pyria. Not only was a fleet almost always required to take a coastal city, the Ptolemy's strength was traditionally naval. Though it was no longer unchallenged, Seleucus would need a fleet of his own to defend from reinforcements sent out of Cyprus and Crete or the Aegean Islands. So while the shipyards of Ionia went to work building a brand new Seleucid navy, Seleucus and his family focused on preparing their supply lines and protecting the rear. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. After almost a century of tension with the unconquered petty kingdoms of northern Anatolia, Seleucus wanted to make sure that none of them would ally with Ptolemy and attack Seleucid territory once he could go south. Cappadocia was already a solid Seleucid ally at this point. Through the marriage of King Ariarathes III and Seleucus' sister, Stratonike. However, the young king wanted another friend in the north to keep the rest in check. So Seleucus' other sister, a younger Laodike, was quickly married off to King Mithridates II of Pontus. At this point, Mithridates was a young and very inexperienced king, probably just reaching the minimum age to rule on his own after a lengthy regency. It seems likely that he was even younger than Laodike and Seleucus, and this must have seemed like a great opportunity for the bride-to-be to become an influence on her new husband's royal policy. Confusingly, some timelines of Hellenistic history just kind of leave Seleucus and his army in the void for 2 or 3 years after Ptolemy returned to Egypt. As far as I can tell, this is just based on incomplete information focused on the city of Arados in the Seleucus district of Syria. Arados was home to an important mint which the Ptolemies kept until 242. But Arados was right on the border of Ptolemaic control at the best of times, and Seleucid coinage returned to Antioch around 244. So we can shift information around a little bit. An undated inscription from the new-ish city of Smyrna provides the framework for our narrative here. At some point, probably in late 245 or early 244, Seleucus and his uncle's forces crossed the Taurus Mountains and entered the Seleucus. But they probably did not immediately go west and assault Antioch. That would have left Xanthippus and the Ptolemaic occupation force in Mesopotamia to their rear. It would also have left the agricultural heartland of the Seleucid Empire in Ptolemaic hands, free to keep sending produce out through the Persian Gulf and into the Red Sea to relieve the Egyptian famine. So Antiochus most likely went east and ran the invaders out of Babylonia first, firmly reclaiming Seleucia on the Euphrates, Babylon, and whatever other territory had fallen under the Egyptian yoke during the previous year. A relatively short Mesopotamian occupation would also help explain why local scribes kept acknowledging Seleucus as king rather than Ptolemy. There just wasn't that much time for them to make a switch. Only after Xanthippus' defeat did Antiochus turn around and march back through Seleucus, where resistance was seemingly minimal from the Ptolemaic occupation in the cities between central Mesopotamia and Antioch itself. By 244, the capital was back in Seleucid hands, and Seleucus was honored with a new epithet, much better than the bearded. Now he was Seleucus Callinicus, the beautifully triumphant. To celebrate, the king wanted to name a new city after his new title. But alas, even the massive Seleucid Empire was starting to run out of good places to build new colonial encampments. And even existing native cities to give a Greek name. So he turned to Nikephorion, previously known as the Babylonian city of Tetul, renamed by Alexander the Great. Seleucus renamed it once again as Callinicum. Callinicum would undergo a few more renaming ceremonies before finally landing on its modern title, Raqqa. With Arados and Apamea on the Orontes, aka the modern Nahr al-Asi in Syria, remaining under Ptolemaic control until 242, we have to do some guesswork to fill in the next 2 years. The probable explanation here lies in some very indirect references from three Roman historians, Appian, Polybius, and Livy, who all seem to be referencing a shared but now lost source about Seleucus's successors when they say that an unspecified Ptolemy conquered Thrace from an earlier Seleucid king. Given that the Third Syrian War is the only conflict we know about that fits into the timeline, Ptolemy III must have launched an assault in the northern Mediterranean once the rebellion in Egypt had settled. This seemingly coincided with an outbreak of conflict on the coast of Anatolia. When Seleucus returned to Antioch, the city of Magnesia by Sipylos rebelled, presumably in favor of Ptolemy, or maybe it was some sort of tax dispute, who knows. This Magnesia was not a big or even all that important city, but it did play a role in guarding the inland river routes that facilitated trade between the coast and Sardis. So retaking it was important but did not require royal attention. Seeing an opportunity to gain some royal favor, the neighboring city of Smyrna rallied its local militia and went to war with Magnesia in the style of classical Greek city-states. They handily defeated the Magnesians, and as a reward, Seleucus merged the two cities into one polis, with the Smyrnan government in control. Meanwhile, Euergetes dispatched his uncle, or half-brother, probably the son of one of Philadelphus's concubines named Andromache, to conquer the northern Seleucid coast. This was Ptolemy Andromachus, who we only know about from one very fragmentary scrap of papyrus in Egypt and one or two sentences from the later rhetorician Athenaeus. Andromachus seemingly began his assault in Thrace at the city of Aenos, modern Turkish Enes, near the Greek border, and worked his way west along the Thracian coast to Maraneia, then cut down through the Cyclades Islands. Andromachus drew the attention of the Macedonian navy, the Antigonids, which engaged him in a naval battle near the island of Andros around this time. We don't have an exact date for the battle, but it was seemingly while the Third Syrian War was still happening. However, the cause for this particular battle may have been more related to Ptolemy Euergetes taking a role in Greek politics around the same time. Andros marked another major naval victory for the Antigonids, effectively driving Ptolemaic influence out of the Cyclades altogether when they sunk Andromachus' own flagship. However, he still had enough naval force to threaten and seize control of Ephesus on the Ionian coast, conquering it away from the Seleucids. Although it was not the end of Ptolemaic control in the city, Ephesus ultimately doomed Andromachus. He had hired Thracian mercenaries to back up his sailors, but must not have been able to pay them sufficiently, because they rebelled after taking Ephesus. Andromachus and his mistress fled to the great temple of Artemis for sanctuary, but the mercenaries ignored that sanctity and murdered them both at the altar. Despite these losses in the north, Seleucus Callinicus redoubled his efforts in the south. His army pushed forward, conquering Arados and Apamea on the Orontes, before launching a counteroffensive to retake Damascus and deep into Ptolemaic Phoenicia. Of course, Ptolemy III could hardly allow that to stand. He had come to terms with allowing Seleucus to burn resources reconquering Seleucid territory, but trying to capture new Ptolemaic lands could not be allowed. Egyptian forces halted the Seleucid advance around the Phoenician Tripoli and pushed them back to the smaller port of Orthosius, while another Ptolemaic army marched inland to besiege the Seleucids at Damascus. Seleucus successfully held both cities under siege, but needed reinforcements to continue this campaign. That was fine, in theory. He had left many troops in reserve back in Anatolia, officially under the command of his teenage brother Antiochus Hierax. Around this time, Seleucus did have two young sons, a little boy named Alexander, and a newborn, another Antiochus. However, they were very young, and Antiochus Hierax would have been the de facto heir to the throne. Hierax was made some sort of viceroy, whether that was officially co-king or something akin to the old Achaemenid Kerenos, we don't know. Antiochus was officially in command of all of Anatolia on his brother's behalf while Seleucus went to war. However, their mother Laodike I and uncle Alexander were the adults in the room and had significant influence over young Antiochus. We don't know which of that royal trio first hatched the plan. Antiochus was certainly old enough to be a willing participant, even if it wasn't his idea. But whether he was officially the junior king or not, he was proclaimed King Antiochus during the Third Syrian War. When Seleucus asked his younger brother for reinforcements, the younger king and Uncle Alexander began organizing their troops, but they did not send the army to Syria. Under Seleucus' leadership, they had lost Mesopotamia, two fleets, large chunks of the Ionian coast, and all of their European possessions. Laodike, Alexander, and young Antiochus decided that the empire really needed a change in management. So they prepared for war, not with Ptolemy, but with Seleucus Callinicus. Seleucus, realizing that if he wanted to keep his empire, he could not press any further against Ptolemy, negotiated a hasty peace that effectively solidified the borders as they were at this stage in the war. Seleucus had retaken territory in Syria, Mesopotamia, and the eastern edge of Cilicia. Ptolemy had taken all of Thrace, a couple of islands, and most of Ionia, with the exception of Miletus, because it's Miletus. I'm unclear on the current status of Damascus, because a lot of historians tend to treat it as Ptolemaic, but every source I can find describing this time suggests that it's in Seleucid hands. It's entirely possible that the city fell at some point between our last reference in the written record and the peace treaty, though. The only major city in Syria to remain in Ptolemaic hands was, embarrassingly, the key port of Seleucia Pyria, the very first city that Ptolemy Euergetes had conquered, and like so many ports, one that Seleucus simply did not have the naval capacity to reclaim. That put a lot more distance between Antioch and the next nearest city on the coast. Regardless, the King of the North and the King of the South agreed to leave their war frozen in place for the time being, allowing Ptolemy to consolidate his newly won territory, and Seleucus to turn his army around and march north for another War of the Brothers. But that is a story for next time. Until then. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.